So I am Noam Shiver, senior editor at the New Republic, and we are doing a Bogging Heads episode on Monday, November 17th, and I'm joined by
Ben Smith. I'm a reporter for Politico.com.
And since we're about 2 weeks beyond Election Day, we figured it was probably best to start off with what everybody wants, which is transition gossip and innuendo. And the biggest of the troublings at this point seems to be the idea of Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. So maybe I should throw it over to you, Ben. Ask what you're hearing and whether you think this is a good idea, an inspired idea, or a disastrous idea.
I mean, you know, I initially dismissed this in the face of real evidence, you know, that it was going to happen, and now it does seem likely that it is going to happen. He's clearly made an offer. She seems likely to accept it. The bar they've set is not too high. It's not a matter of pouring through Bill Clinton's past, just getting a promise from him that he's not going to do anything, you know, damaging to them in the future, which is seems like an easier thing to control, or maybe not that easy to control. I mean, I think it's a big risk. I think there are a lot of reasons that it's a great idea. It seems like she might be good at the job. She would bring sort of immediate stature to it, certainly. And it's sort of a big gesture. I mean, you know, he clearly wants to have a big administration and do big things, and this is a very large gesture in that way. I mean, the downside is that a lot of the coverage of his foreign policy, at least initially, is going to be coverage of whether she's trying to undermine him or not, kind of microscopic coverage of her every utterance in that light. And I think that may be distracting.
Yeah, I guess tend to agree with you. I'm not super wild about it. I do think that the stature thing is a real plus. I mean, I think it's probably helpful if you're Secretary of State have real star power, so that when you go meet with the president of Egypt or wherever, that person it's like a real coup for them to be meeting with you, and it really enhances their stature to have met with you, which is always useful probably for the sort of bargaining that you want to do or that you need to do as Secretary of State. So I think her stature and her celebrity has real pluses, but I agree with you. It just makes me queasy in so many respects. You know, the Washington Post had this story today in the context of the vetting of Bill Clinton about, you know, how one of the benefits to her would be that she brings this additional leverage of the Clinton Foundation and the Clinton Global Initiative. You know, she can say to a foreign leader, well, you know, we may not be able to get this aid package through Congress, but if you talk to my husband about it or my husband's foundation, and that just sent shivers down my spine.
I can imagine it would have sent shivers down a lot of people in the Obama campaign.
Absolutely.
If that was done very officially, you could imagine it being useful. But just the idea that there would be this kind of quasi-independent arm of government,
right?
You know, where the money, it wasn't clear where the money was coming from, wasn't clear where it was going. I mean, he does a lot of, like, you know, just totally positive things, getting money from the government of Sweden and sending it to the government of Namibia. I mean, I made that up. But, I mean, you know, then certainly that's worthy, but the idea that he'd be doing it while having a back channel to the Secretary of State just obviously can't happen. I mean, I think that one of the things, the other things is just sort of, you know, what happens when, you know, when the President of Iran attacks her and then he's asked for comment? Is he just going to kind of free associate, or is he going to be speaking for the American government?
Right.
I mean, seems tricky. I mean, not impossible, but tricky.
No, I agree. Very, very tricky. And to me, I think, you know, you hear a lot about this sort of team of rivals idea. And, you know, I haven't read Doris Kearns Goodwin's book, but my sense is the upshot is that it worked out reasonably well for Lincoln. But I'm just always incredibly leery of these historical analogies. I mean, I just think that they end up being so crude, and that you're rarely sort of able to capture the kind of subtle reasons that something worked or didn't work. And so I just think, like, it's a pretty crude mode of analysis just to suggest that if you bring a couple of your strong-minded, you know, former rivals into your cabinet, that this is going to be an unambiguously good thing. It strikes me that there are many, many more ways where this could be a disaster than that it could be a good thing. And it was probably a pretty kind of rarefied set of circumstances that it allowed it to work.
The other side of it, though, is that it's not like Hillary Clinton ceases to exist either way, and the alternative is having her in the Senate. at a moment when he seems poised really to like run the table in this sort of amazing way in Washington. And she could potentially have emerged as an obstacle.
Right.
In Washington, he's getting her out of off Capitol Hill.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, I think, you know, it's the old mantra about pissing in versus pissing out, and maybe you do want her pissing out. But yeah, no, I just think, you know, maybe there were better ways to accomplish this. I don't know if she would sort of accept a Supreme Court appointment, but that strikes me as, you know, maybe the safer move. You know, my own instinct is, you know, and we're going to talk about this anyway, that I kind of like her at defense better than at state. She's not gallivanting all over the world quite as frenetically there. She actually has some experience in military affairs, having served on the Senate Armed Services Committee. And, you know, maybe you get even a little more bang for your buck because she would be the first female Secretary of Defense. I don't know. I almost prefer to see her at defense, if anything, rather than state if he's gonna do a big Hillary appointment.
Right, but, you know, it is a matter of these specific choices, and he does seem to be signaling that he's going to keep Gates at defense. And replacing Gates with Hillary Clinton at defense would send a totally different signal to the uniform military. You know, about dramatic change, basically.
Yeah, no, I think that's right.
So then you're down to your choices for state, right? And you're down to, I guess, I mean, I don't know, is there another, like, Democrat with a lot of stature who's an obvious choice, who's not Bill Clinton, Bill Richardson, Richard Holbrooke, or John Kerry, who've all been discussed at length and all kind of have obvious flaws in a certain way?
I mean, the only other name I guess you hear in the mix is Dennis Ross, who's not like a partisan Democrat, but a guy who's been at state for years and years through various administrations and is obviously pretty experienced and has stature. I mean, he's clearly not an international celebrity or even a domestic, you know, personage of the order of John Kerry or Bill Richardson, but he seems to be a very capable guy who the bureaucrats at Foggy Bottom would probably welcome.
Right, but I mean, it just seems like Obama, in the choices he's made so far, is clearly choosing kind of big over small.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that seems to be part of that.
I think that's right, and maybe we should segue into Treasury, too, since there's a similar sort of big versus small dynamic.
You laid it out really well, the choice between Larry Summers and Tim Geithner. Where's that headed?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you guys reported late last week that Summers is beginning to encounter some resistance, or not encountering resistance, but the resistance from feminist groups may be starting to have some impact on the process. I personally, you know, not surprisingly, think it would be a real shame if that derailed, you know, the nomination of a guy who is unquestionably, you know, overwhelmingly qualified for the job. And you know, my sense is probably the strong voice that Obama needs on the economy. I mean, I think there's going to be a lot of pressure on Obama to kind of split the difference on a stimulus package. You know, $600 billion is really big, and, you know, maybe $100 billion isn't enough, so $300 billion sounds about right. And I think you need a guy with Summer's stature and intellectual heft to say, no, that's crazy. Difference splitting is not what we need to be doing now. $600 billion is the way to go. You know, so I just think it would be a real shame if we didn't get that guy as a result of
his Summers would be more on the pattern of the people he seems to be picking so far, which is a former Clinton administration experienced guy who not everyone gets along with. I mean, that sort of describes
right.
both Hillary and Emmanuel.
That's right. You know, I mean, having said that, I think other people, I just wrote this profile of Tim Geithner where I mentioned Summers quite a bit too, and you know, I think the advantage of Geithner is he brings a lot of the upside of Summers but without some of the downside. Now, he's not, by his own admission, I think he wouldn't consider himself the sort of brilliant intellectual heavyweight that Summers is. I think few people would, but Geithner probably gets you sort of, you know, 85% of the way there, maybe 90% of the way there, and does have the advantage of not appearing to be a Clinton administration retread. So maybe the calculus in this particular case gets you away from the model that you've been talking about.
I haven't covered him at all, but does he have a press office? He gets great press.
He does have a press
office.
Is he
been spinning?
He's got a very...
And was he calling you up in the middle of the night, feeding you stuff for that story?
No. I will say, he has a press person, a guy named Calvin Mitchell, who's phenomenally well-informed. I won't go beyond that, but he has some very smart people who work for him. And they really know their stuff. I think Geithner himself is just very sophisticated about the way he deals with everybody in Washington. I mean, I think this was true throughout his tenure in the 90s at Treasury, where he started off as basically a career civil servant and rose to be Undersecretary for International Affairs, which is the top international official. So, the guy is very good at navigating bureaucracy, dealing with big, personalities, dealing with prima donnas, dealing with civil servants. I mean, he's just across the board has an incredibly smooth touch. And, maybe if you have a lot of these big personalities in the cabinet already, it wouldn't hurt to have someone with a very good touch.
And he's been at he's been at this specific table, right? I mean, that kind of helps, I think.
Absolutely, absolutely. He's been at the table with Paulson and Bernanke in making some of these bailout decisions. He's also was at the table in the 90s with Summers and Bob Rubin in making a lot of the decisions about whether to bail out, the Koreas and the Thailands and the Indonesias that were melting down in the 90s. So the guy has definitely been, through the ringer when it comes to crisis situations.
And there'd be some continuity. I mean, he's sort of more in the mix right now than Summers is.
Absolutely, absolutely. You could argue that maybe that's not a good thing. Maybe we want a sharper break from the sort of Paulson Bernanke approach, and that Geithner wouldn't bring enough of one. But I suspect if left to his own devices, he'd take a slightly different tack than we've seen so far. So do you, you had, this has been the part of the subtext that we've been talking about, but you and a colleague published on Friday a piece about just the proliferation of Clintonites in Obama's, discussions about White House staff, cabinet, and certainly will continue below the cabinet level. Beyond just Hillary and Rahm, this is going to be a government of Clintonites. What's the deal?
Well, I think there are two things going on. One is that it's as somebody said to me, the Obama has a Democratic Party with a usable past. The Clinton administration lasted 8 years, was pretty successful on a lot of fronts, and every experienced policy hand from every experienced Democratic policy hand from the executive branch, necessarily worked in there. And it's, people in their 30s and 40s and 50s, it's largely not the top tier we're talking about. It's people who were deputy assistants and things like that who are now, now ready for more senior positions. And that seems kind of natural and obvious in a way that you wouldn't have some kind of, ban on them. Although at times Obama seems to suggest the Clinton administration had really been a negative thing. He's kind of in the general election, he backed away from that. And ultimately he is, although he ran as a Washington outsider, he's very comfortable with the Washington policy wonk establishment. Much of which is drawn from the Clinton administration. The other thing I think that's really important and a little bit undertold is how big a shift it was from having a campaign run by David Plouffe to a transition run by John Podesta. I mean, Plouffe was really like the central voice of Washington outsiderhood, of skepticism of the Clintons inside that campaign.
Right.
Having spent time on the Hill in the late 90s, watching the Clinton kind of not live up to what people saw as his promise in a certain way and get dragged down by Monica. And so I think that's a really important shift. I think Podesta is like a very different character with a different kind of set of priorities.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, I think Plouffe, one of the interesting things to me about Plouffe is that he was hired by Dick Gephardt when Dick Gephardt was thinking about challenging Al Gore in 2000, and that seems to me like an important formative experience, that these guys were basically trying to figure out how to beat the sort of Clinton establishment and were kind of alienated from at the time. And of course the Clintons and the Gore and the Clinton universes were more merged at that point, and the Clinton Gore people really kind of went out of their way to stiff arm Gephardt and try to make life difficult for him. So you're right. I mean, there was this real, even more than just being an outsider, almost an alienation from the Clinton establishment that Pluff embodied, and I think Axelrod, you know, had his own reasons for kind of feeling that way too. I agree with you. I think it's a huge shift. I mean, one of the things, you know, that I think is at play here, which I think often gets overlooked, is that Obama just doesn't have that many cronies. You know, like he's not a guy who was governor of a state for 10 years like right. Bill Clinton was, who just had, you know, dozens and dozens of people who he'd hired over the years and who he could sort of draw on, you know, both his actual personnel and
a lot of his cronies worked in the Clinton administration. I mean, if you're looking for cronies, it's the Harvard Law School guys. It's Mike Furman and Julius Genachowski, who both were quite seen. Because if you're a high-powered Democrat at Harvard Law, you know, in the early 90s, like where you're going is the Clinton administration.
Right.
So Furman, his two, I think, close friends from Harvard Law who were working on the transition. Furman was Rubin's deputy at Treasury, and Genachowski was Reed Hunt's deputy, I guess, at the FCC. Right. But like, these are guys whose loyalty really is to Obama in this campaign. So it's, you know, you say they're on the list of people who worked in the Clinton administration. But I think a lot of the people who worked in the Clinton administration, you know, don't see themselves as Clinton people, as being wholly owned by the Clintons. And, you know, there is a level of, like, campaign staff that you are not seeing coming into the administration.
Right.
Like, in fact, there's only one of Clinton's sort of inner political circle, the policy director, Neera Tanden, who I think is now in Obama's orbit.
Right. Yeah, I think, I mean, look, I think Genachowski and Furman are both, like, clearly key figures that Obama trusts, and you know, they go way back. But, like, it just seemed like that Clinton had dozens of these people when he came into town, you know?
Yeah.
I mean,
Law School,
Oxford, Arkansas.
Right.
And Obama just seems to have, like, you know, maybe, like, a half a dozen of them or something, you know?
Yeah, you know, you run a – it's true. A Senate office is so different from running a state or a city. I mean, although there is a Chicago world, I suspect we're going to see if, you know, one of the names that's been floated for Secretary of Education is the guy running Chicago schools. There's Valerie Jarrett. I think there's a bigger universe than people realize of kind of Chicago policy. And you know, I think people at Treasury may come from Chicago, too. Like, I think there is actually a fairly large world of Chicago insiders who are going to have...
Yeah, but
are
those people, I mean, I think you're right. I think those people will invariably migrate to Washington. Obama will bring them here. But I don't get the sense that, I mean, they're not cronies in the sense that, you know, half the government of Arkansas were Clinton. You know, Obama didn't hire them. You know, they didn't work
personally.
Obama
doesn't owe them much.
It just seems like a slightly different
sensibility.
You know, one of the things that you and I had sort of talked about over email, and you'd posted a bit about this last week, which I thought was really interesting, has to do with the McCain side of the election, just to switch gears a bit. And it's this idea that I think appeared in Ryan Liz's New Yorker retrospective, and also in an interview that Joel Benenson gave to Time magazine. Actually, my wife, Amy Sullivan, interviewed him, which is that...
By her book.
McCain people sort of assumed that they had this really well-established maverick brand, but what the Obama people discovered was that it actually wasn't true, that kind of ordinary people out in the hinterlands didn't really associate him with this maverick image, and that was something the Obama people really exploited. I mean, what do you make of that? It seems like kind of a huge oversight on the McCain campaign's part, if true.
Yeah, I mean, it's so funny. It's just amazing. That Benenson interview was amazing. I think that's right. I mean, like, he was, for all the idea that they were running against the media, the John McCain, they were believing. I mean, all along, they, much more than the Obama people, believed what they read about their own candidate and about Obama. And they read that he was, you know, widely admired, when in fact he was, like, widely admired by people who appear on Sunday shows. But, like, most people in America just kind of didn't know who he was. Like, a very vague sense that he was that guy who ran for president 8 years ago. But, like, I think there are very, very few political figures who have kind of, like, penetrated to that level of public knowledge where people have a clear impression of who they are. And Rudy Giuliani is certainly one. But I think Giuliani was probably the only one in that Republican field who people had much idea who he was. And people outside the primary states, like in New Hampshire, I think people probably had a reasonably good idea who McCain was. But, it's amazing. And so Obama defined him in this way that, like, I think to to a lot of the reporters and kind of political professionals watching it, we almost kind of like shrugged it off. All these McCain, Bush, like, yeah, you see what they're trying to do, but actually that is, they defined him effectively.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. In fact, I was kind of hammering this home during the general. I thought they were making a huge mistake by not just sort of conceding in their ads, conceding that McCain had been at one point admirable and kind of a maverick and, you know, kind of, you know, fought his party on some important issues.
What happened to the old John McCain?
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, it was ambition that caused him to sort of run and embrace the president and embrace the conservative wing of his party. I thought that's the route they should have gone. Obviously, I didn't know what I was talking about, and the Obama people did. They had the data. But I think it's like, you know, it's one thing for me in my armchair at my computer not to know what I'm talking about. It's another thing for, like, the McCain people not to know. You know, it seems pretty stunning, and just as a reflection of, just on a mechanical level, the incompetence of the campaign, that they wouldn't do a certain amount of polling to check to see how well established the brand was. I mean, maybe they did and they just drew a different conclusion, but it seems to me like it was just a major strategic weakness that, you know, you could just drive an 18-wheeler through, which the Obama people obviously did. So I almost see it as, I mean, on its own terms, it's pretty remarkable, but as a testament to sort of what was going on in the McCain campaign, I think it's almost more so.
Well, I think, I don't know. I mean, I think they knew, they realized or decided that they had to take down Obama and that they had to basically be running as the safe alternative to an unacceptable Democrat, you know, that was the only way in this year to win. And so, I mean, I think maybe there was some argument that not to waste your time making the positive case, because I mean, beyond, I mean, and actually the thing that Palin really undermined was the idea, this idea grew that McCain was a risky vote.
Right.
But, right. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, they had a pretty bad hand. But it was just a place where, like, the Washington conventional wisdom was just totally wrong.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And the Obama people, you know, like, there were moments in the campaign when they would say, and I was thinking, you know, are they spinning or is this real? Like, what are the McCain people doing? Like, look, this ad makes no sense.
Right.
And I guess they were right in the end on some of that.
Right. So speaking of Palin, I mean, your publication has been covering the sort of Palin post-election media circuit and her appearance at the Governors Association meeting in Florida last week. I mean, what do you make of all this, all the hoopla? I mean, is it legitimate in that she's going to be a legitimate contender for the nomination in 2012, and so this is just the kind of the opening rounds of that, or is it just this kind of gruesome fascination with a train wreck that's sort of still continuing after Election Day?
I mean, couldn't it be both?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, but John, I mean, she does seem like she's absorbed whatever message the Republican Party might be trying to assemble right now. At the moment, the message is like, hey, look, Sarah Palin.
Right.
I mean, Jonathan Martin has had a great story from down at the RGA in Miami last week where, I mean, it just sort of seemed clear she didn't come to say anything in particular. She just said she kind of attacked Obama, and then she said it was time to move on from Obama, and all these other Republican governors are basically standing there rolling their eyes while she talks. I mean, I don't know. What do you think? Palin 2012?
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually, we've debated this in our office, and I'm actually really, I just think it's an incredibly remote possibility. I'd love for it to happen. I mean, I think nothing would guarantee Obama's reelection like Palin being the party's nominee, the GOP nominee, but I have a hard time seeing it. I mean, I think she's more destined to be sort of a wacky historical footnote. That, you know, that we kind of look back on and people make jokes about in 10 or 15 years, if not sooner. But I just think for a couple of reasons. One, I think just being physically in Alaska, it just makes it so hard to build the infrastructure that you need to run a credible campaign, just to get the consultants that you need to kind of be with you have their sort of undivided attention. I mean, yeah, they can make phone calls, they can take a trip out there every now and then, you can check in with them when you come to Washington, but it's not the same as having like the sort of inner circle that, say, George W. Bush assembled with Karl Rove in the 90s in preparation for a presidential run. I think we saw that kind of, you know, people who for whom the idea of their candidacy is more attractive than the actual candidacy itself, it often doesn't quite work out. You know, I mean, Fred
right.
Thompson was sort of an example of this. A lot of consultants were sort of half in and half out and sort of liked the idea, and, you know, they would sort of do things a new way and use technology so he wouldn't have to kind of be in the mix as much as possible, and it just kind of came to nothing. And which is not to say that the Thompson situation is as analogous is super analogous to Palin, but just that you sort of need people who are kind of really committed to the idea and willing to develop a lot of infrastructure and do some long term planning. And it's just not clear.
You don't
to
think
me.
Randy Shoneman's moving to Anchorage?
Are you saying that jokingly?
I agree with you. I mean, but also just like she was not a good performer. Like, although
yeah.
she clearly was good at something, like it was not getting votes for John McCain or herself in the end.
No, I think that's right. I mean, I think
so. I think there is a case to make where like she goes back to Alaska, she governs really effectively for a couple of years. Kind of reaches back out to the Democrats there, whatever, you know, and then starts giving it, gives an interview to David Brooks in 2 years where she says,
right.
you know, David, you were right, I wasn't ready.
Right.
You, Rich Lowry, you know, I read your column and it, you
right.
know, I realized how true it was.
Right.
And like kind of makes her way and doesn't come across and you know, learns is not as much policy as like, you know, George W. Bush knew when he was running.
Right.
And you know, and that like it's certainly like in theory doable. It's just like the performance, you know? And just I think there's this central flaw to the way she was running. She was talking about the real America. Like, the problem with that wasn't so much that it was divisive, it's just that she was wrong.
Right.
Like, she's talking, like, what the percentage of Americans who live in outside cities and suburbs
right.
is, like, below 20% and shrinking.
Right.
And so, like, that's not a viable, I mean, maybe in a Republican primary,
yeah.
but even then, it's, like, it's really tough to run against the suburbs and the city. Like, that's where people live.
No, I agree. I mean, my hope is that, you know, it is viable in a Republican primary because, as you say, it's not at all viable in a general election. So I think Republicans would be making, like, just a catastrophically bad mistake if they were to go that route. I mean, I do think you're right. She becomes more plausible if she follows the model you suggest. She goes back.
She needs to get out of.
Studies
out. I kind of disagree with you. I think she needs to like really vacate the lower 48 for a while.
Uh huh.
Because I was listening to some of course you know snooty NPR show over the weekend while I drove, and they said they've gotten a lot of email complaining that they were still making fun of Sarah Palin. You know,
uh-huh.
after the election, and to which they responded, you know, we're not going to stop until she does.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's true of the entire kind of like comedy establishment.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think she does. I agree with you. I think she does need to return to Alaska and kind of take her day job seriously and study up, and then kind of reemerge a couple of years later. I don't think it's in her to do that. I think she's kind of a diva. She kind of craves the attention, and just that she doesn't realize that she's not well served at all by the freak show. You know, the other reason I think that even if she were to do that, I'm still sort of down on her chances because I just think her chief reflex is to kind of use grievance politics, which, you know, which is not just, you know, something that doesn't have a bad track record among conservatives, but in a Republican primary, it just seems really unlikely to work. I mean, she often cries sort of, she often plays a kind of gender card and a media card, media bias and gender bias, and I think those two things aren't going to work at all in a Republican primary. I mean, the people that you're going to be getting into it with, you know, and the people who are your audience are going to be your audience are people who don't take gender bias very seriously at all, unless they can use it as a club against Democrats.
You know, it's hard to predict. I mean, a Sarah Palin Bobby Jindal primary would be fascinating.
No, yeah, it absolutely would.
And I mean, she would have an like just in terms of like a cultural edge identifying with a lot of people.
I think she would, I think that's right. I think she would, and I think because of the kind of types of attacks that she's prone to making, she certainly, if she didn't get the nomination, could potentially mortally wound Jindal. You know, so it's again, if you're an Obama supporter and want to see him reelected in 2012, you probably lust for a Jindal Palin matchup. The damage they could do to one another is sort of, you know, Iran-Iraq War-esque.
It's just so hard to know, though. I mean, like, the context for that primary, we just don't know whether Obama is a strong and popular president or a weak and unpopular one.
Absolutely. So a final, two things, penultimate topic. The New Yorker, George Packer of the New Yorker, this past issue, the one that came out last Monday, had an interesting piece about sort of which Obama we're likely to see at the outset of his administration. Is it going to be this sort of non-ideological, sort of small-bore, pragmatic, cautious, moderate guy, or are we going to see a sort of sweeping vision given the scale of the economic problems that we face? And Packer sort of seems to suggest that we may get more of the latter. I'm sort of curious, obviously you've watched this guy for a couple of years now. I mean, do you think he has it in him to be kind of sweeping and ambitious, even sort of radical, you know, in a way that might be appropriate now?
You know, I don't know. Somebody asked me the other day, like, what's the one thing, the one principle that Barack Obama will push no matter what, would never back off, and is totally non-negotiable? And I couldn't really think of one.
Yeah.
I mean, his principles are kind of about process.
Right.
And about negotiation and accommodation and, you know, making people comfortable with stuff. But what the stuff is seems kind of less relevant, and certainly the way he ran his campaign. But, you know, I think it would be pretty radical just to pass the things that we've taken for granted as Democratic and actually also McCain agenda items. A huge stimulus package, a robust cap-and-trade system, and a huge tax hike on the rich, like, which is just standard platform of every Democrat. And, like, you know, that's kind of what's in the cards, and that actually does seem fairly major.
I think that's right, though. I think that the details matter. I mean, $300 billion would be a big stimulus, but it might not be enough given the economic circumstances. I mean, you might need a $600 billion or a $750 billion dollar stimulus with all sorts of, you know, investments and infrastructure and jobs, you know, basically job-creating programs. And I'm just not sure whether he's sort of got it in him kind of sensibility-wise to do that. You know, I mean, I could see it going either way. I mean, one, you know, him sort of recoiling from the kind of radicalism of that sort of proposal, even though it may be the right way to go. Or two, I mean, he does have this other tendency, which is he talks about this a lot. I mean, I remember even 4 years ago when I wrote a piece about him when he had just won a primary in the Senate primary in Illinois, where he talked a lot about kind of having to kind of have the right approach for the times, and this was in the context of a discussion about Clinton and the DLC, and he's like, you know, that may have been perfectly appropriate for the early 90s and the late 80s, but you have to ask if it's the right approach for this moment. And I noticed last night on his 60 Minutes interview, he also talked a lot about, you know, having the right approach for the moment and how you know, you wouldn't do the same thing that FDR did at the outset of his administration, right, because the moment just changed. I do think he's very self-conscious about the moment that he's operating in, and he may just realize that the moment kind of calls for a sort of sweeping, even radical approach, and that may do it for him. So I kind of see a tension there. I mean, I think he's capable of the radical approach because it's just what the moment calls for, though I do think his natural instincts are the opposite of radical. They're actually pretty cautious.
You did that piece, a really interesting piece today on his, on like sort of how the texture is changing as it shifts toward, and how there's a little more drama being introduced as the transition goes on and moves away from the campaign. I mean, what are the personnel choices and like that stuff kind of say to you about the policy?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, just on the question of whether the guy can adapt, I mean, I think he realizes that a couple of things. One, he's got to actually get stuff done now. You know, we're not just talking about electing Obama, but a number there are going to be a number of battles that have to be fought and need people who know how to fight them. And two, that, like, you know, insisting on no drama is almost crazy in a federal government of,
right,
you know, several million people, you know, tens of thousands of which work in Washington and are all, you know, many of them like to go blabbing to reporters when they don't get their way. So I think he's just sort of decided that, you know, no drama is great, but we've actually have things to do here. And that may be the more important imperative, which I think speaks well of his sort of ability to adjust to changing circumstances.
So
I guess maybe we should end on the final on a final topic that sort of occupied you and me to some extent over the weekend, which is who might get appointed to the New York Senate seat should Hillary, as we expect, take a position in Obama's cabinet.
Well, I love this topic, and I covered New York politics for years. And I mean, unfortunately, the real issue here is David Patterson, the governor, is actually, you know, fairly, could find himself in a very tough re-election battle. He was not elected in the first place. Rudy Giuliani is looming. The sort of swing voters are going to be kind of conservative, upstate slash suburban, white ethnic voters. So kind of an Andrew Cuomo, the attorney general, is probably the likeliest. In part because I think he might worry that Andrew would undercut him if he didn't appoint him. But the choice, the dark horse here, I would say, is Eliot Spitzer, who's, you know, in the time as counted by contemporary news cycles, his disgrace was thousands of years ago. And he is, you know, he did build his reputation as an enforcer of Wall Street, as a very kind of detailed, specific and also broad knowledge of and sense of, you know, what how Wall Street should be reformed. He wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post yesterday, basically expressing his vindication on that front. You know, why not?
No, I agree with you. I really like the idea of the guy clearly has expertise in this area that's going to be sort of so pressing as Obama takes over. And, you know, I think, you know, a lot of times with people like him, you have these conversations. I mean, we had it with Giuliani too. Like, do they really want to be in the legislature? These guys are used to being executives and kind of being tough guys and getting their way. But I think what you saw with Spitzer is that that actually didn't serve him super well as governor. I mean,
that did not turn out to work well. I mean,
no,
unfortunately, it did not turn out
to work well. But I actually think being sort of one of 100 senators may actually be better for him, you know, because then there's no escaping at that point that you've got to kind of play well with others. I mean, I think the delusion that he had going into Albany was that he could still be this sort of cowboy attorney general that he was, when it just clearly wasn't true. He tried to roll over people, and that's just not the way the process works. What I think is, you know, if he were in Washington, I think he'd be sort of keeping people honest on this stuff, but just realize that you're one of 100 and you have one vote, and you do have to kind of, you know, respect the process of this. So it might actually sort of temper some of the things that were problematic for him.
I think it would be great for Eliot Spitzer. We just have to make the case to Patterson.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, no, I agree with you. I don't see it happening, but it's an inspired idea, and I applaud you for it.
All right. Well, nice talking to you, Noam.
Nice talking to you, too. Take care.
Yeah.